an admiral only. But now, as first citizen and future conqueror, he needed more. He needed heirs who could unite his future dominions, something the mule had never had, which was why his empire did not survive his strange non-human life. He, Stettin, needed someone of the great historic families of the Foundation with whom he could fuse dynasties. He wondered testily why he did not rid himself of Kallion now. It would be no trouble. She would whine a bit. He dismissed the thought. She had her points, occasionally. Kallion was cheering up now. The influence of Greybeard was gone, and her Poochie's granite face was softening now. She lifted herself in a single fluid motion and melted toward him. "You're not going to scold me, are you?"
"No."
He patted her absently. "Now just sit quietly for a while, will you? I want to think."
"About the man from the Foundation?"
"Yes."
"Poochie."
This was a pause. "What?"
"Poochie, the man has a little girl with him, you said, remember? Could I see her when she comes?
Now what do you think I want him to bring his brat with him for? Is my audience room to be a grammar school? Enough of your nonsense, Kallia."
"But I'll take care of her, Poochie. You won't even have to bother with her. It's just that I hardly ever see children, and you know how I love them."
He looked at her sardonically. She never tired of this approach. She loved children, i.e. his children, i.e. his legitimate children, i.e. marriage. He laughed. "This particular little piece," he said, "is a great girl of 14 or 15. She's probably as tall as you are." Kallia looked crushed.
"Well, could I anyway? She could tell me about the Foundation. I've always wanted to go there, you know. My grandfather was a Foundation man. Won't you take me there sometime, Poochie?"
Stettin smiled at the thought. Perhaps he would, as conqueror. This book is continued at this point, on the other side of this cassette. "My grandfather was a Foundation man. Won't you take me there sometime, Poochie?" Stettin smiled at the thought. Perhaps he would, as conqueror. The good nature that the thought supplied him with made itself felt in his words. "I will, I will. And you can see the girl and talk Foundation to her all you want. But not near me, understand?"
"I won't bother you, honestly. I'll have her in my own rooms."
She was happy again. It was not very often these days that she was allowed to have her way. She put her arms about his neck, and after the slightest hesitation, she felt its tendons relax and the large head come softly down upon her shoulder. Chapter 13. Lady. Arcadia felt triumphant. How life had changed since Peleus Anthor had stuck his silly face up against her window, and all because she had the vision and courage to do what needed to be done. Here she was on Kallgan. She had been to the great central theater, the largest in the galaxy, and seen in person some of the singing stars who were famous even in the distant Foundation. She had shopped all on her own along the flowered path, fashion center of the gayest world in space. And she had made her own selections, because Homier just didn't know anything at all about it. The saleswoman raised no objections at all to long, shiny dresses with those vertical sweeps that made her look so tall. And Foundation money went a long, long way. Homier had given her a 10-credit bill, and when she changed it to Kalganian Kalganids, it made a terribly thick sheaf. She had even had her hair redone, a sort of half-short in back, with two glistening curls over each temple. And it was treated so that it looked golder than ever. It just shone. But this was best of all. To be sure, the palace of Lord Stettin wasn't as grand and lavish as the theaters, or as mysterious and historical as the old Palace of the Mule, of which so far they had only glimpsed the lonely towers in their air flight across the planet. But imagine, a real lord. She was wrapped in the glory of it. And not only that, she was actually face to face with his mistress. Arcadia capitalized the word in her mind, because she knew the role such women had played in history, knew their glamour and power. In fact, she had often thought of being an all-powerful and glittering creature herself. But somehow mistresses weren't in fashion at the Foundation just then, and besides, her father probably wouldn't let her if it came to that.
Of course, the Lady Calia didn't quite come up to Arcadia's notion of the part. For one thing, she was rather plump, and didn't look at all wicked and dangerous. Just sort of faded and nearsighted. Her voice was high, too, instead of throaty, and Calia said, "Would you like more tea, child? I'll have another cup, thank you, Your Grace. Or was it Your Highness?" Arcadia continued with a connoisseur's condescension. "Those are lovely pearls you're wearing, my lady." On the whole, my lady seemed best. "Oh, do you think so?" Calia seemed vaguely pleased. She removed them and let them swing milkily to and fro. "Would you like them? You can have them if you like." "Oh, my! You really mean—" She found them in her hand. Then, repelling them mournfully, she said, "Father wouldn't like it." "He wouldn't like the pearls? But they're quite nice pearls." "He wouldn't like my taking them, I mean. You're not supposed to take expensive presents from people," he says. "You aren't." "But, I mean, this was a present to me from from the First Citizen. Was that wrong, do you suppose?" Arcadia reddened. I didn't mean—" But Calia had tired of the subject. She let the pearls slide to the ground and said, "You were going to tell me about the foundation. Please do so right now." And Arcadia was suddenly at a loss. What does one say about a world dulled to tears? To her, the foundation was a suburban town, a comfortable house, the annoying necessities of education, the uninteresting eternities of a quiet life. She said uncertainly, "It's just like you view in the book films, I suppose." "Oh, do you view book films? They give me such a headache when I try. But do you know, I always love video stories about your traders. Such big, savage men. It's always so exciting. Is your friend Mr. Munn one of them? He doesn't seem nearly savage enough. Most of the traders had beards and big bass voices and were so domineering with women. Don't you think so?" Arcadia smiled glassily. "That's just a part of history, my lady. I mean, when the foundation was young, the traders were the pioneers, pushing back the frontiers and bringing civilization to the rest of the galaxy. We learned all about that in school. But that time has passed. We don't have traders anymore, just corporations and things." "Really? What a shame. Then what does Mr. Munn do? I mean, if he's not a trader?" "Uncle Homier's a librarian." Calia put a hand to her lips and tittered. "You mean he takes care of book films? Oh, my. It seems like such a silly thing for a grown man to do." "He's a very good librarian, my lady. It is an occupation that is very highly regarded at the foundation." She put down the little iridescent teacup upon the milky metal table surface. Her hostess was all concern. "But, my dear child, I'm sure I didn't mean to offend you. He must be a very intelligent man. I could see it in his eyes as soon as I looked at him. They were so intelligent. And he must be brave, too, to want to see the Mule's Palace." "Brave?" Arcadia's internal awareness twitched. This was what she was waiting for. Intrigue, intrigue. With great indifference, she asked, staring idly at her thumb tip, "Why must one be brave to wish to see the Mule's Palace?" "Didn't you know?" Her eyes were round, and her voice sank. "There's a curse on it. When he died, the Mule directed that no one ever enter it until the Empire of the Galaxy is established. Nobody on Kalgan would dare even to enter the grounds." Arcadia absorbed that. "But that's superstition." "Don't say that." Calia was distressed. "Poochie always says that. He says it's useful to say it isn't, though, in order to maintain his hold over the people. But I notice he's never gone in himself. And neither did Thalos, who was First Citizen before Poochie." A thought struck her, and she was all curiosity again. "But why does Mr. Munn want to see the palace?" And it was there that Arcadia's careful plan could be put into action. She knew well from the book she had read that a ruler's mistress was the real power behind the throne, that she was the very wellspring of influence. Therefore, if Uncle Homier failed with Lord Stettin, and she was sure he would, she must retrieve that failure with Lady Calia. To be sure, Lady Calia was something of a puzzle. She didn't seem at all bright. But, well, all history proved. She said, "There's a reason, my lady, but will you keep it in confidence?" "Cross my heart," said Calia, making the appropriate gesture on the soft, billowing whiteness of her breast.
Arcadia's thoughts kept a sentence ahead of her words. Uncle Homier is a great authority on the mule, you know. He's written books and books about it, and he thinks that all of galactic history has been changed since the mule conquered the Foundation. Oh, my. He thinks the Selden Plan... Kalia clapped her hands. I know about the Selden Plan. The videos about the traitors were always all about the Selden Plan. It was supposed to arrange to have the Foundation win all the time. Science had something to do with it, though I could never quite see how. I always get so restless when I have to listen to explanations. But you go right ahead, my dear. It's different when you explain. You make everything seem so clear. Arcadia continued, Well, don't you see, then, that when the Foundation was defeated by the Mule, the Selden Plan didn't work, and it hasn't worked since? So who will form the Second Empire? The Second Empire? Yes, one must be formed someday, but how? That's the problem, you see. And there's the Second Foundation. The Second Foundation? She was quite completely lost. Yes, they're the planners of history that are following in the footsteps of Selden. They stopped the Mule because he was premature, but now they may be supporting Kalgan. Why? Because Kalgan may now offer the best chance of being the nucleus for a new empire. Dimly, Lady Kalia seemed to grasp that. You mean Poochie is going to make a new empire? We can't tell for sure. Uncle Homier thinks so, but he'll have to see the Mule's records to find out. It's all very complicated, said Lady Kalia doubtfully. Arcadia gave up. She had done her best. Lord Stetton was in a more or less savage humor. The session with the milksop from the Foundation had been quite unrewarding. It had been worse. It had been embarrassing. To be absolute ruler of 27 worlds, master of the galaxy's greatest military machine, owner of the universe's most vaulting ambition, and left to argue nonsense with an antiquarian. Damnation! He was to violate the customs of Kalgan, was he? To allow the Mule's palace to be ransacked so that a fool could write another book? The cause of science, the sacredness of knowledge, great galaxy. Were these catchwords to be thrown in his face in all seriousness? Besides, and his flesh prickled slightly, there was the matter of the curse. He didn't believe in it. No intelligent man could. But if he was going to defy it, it would have to be for a better reason than any the fool had advanced. What do you want? He snapped, and Lady Kalia cringed visibly in the doorway.
Are you busy?
Yes, I am busy.
But nobody's here, Poochie. Couldn't I even speak to you for a minute?
Oh, Galaxy, what do you want? Now hurry! Her words stumbled.
The little girl told me they were going into the Mule's palace. I thought we could go with her. It must be gorgeous inside.
She told you that, did she? Well, she isn't, and we aren't. Now go tend to your own business. I've had about enough of you.
But, Poochie, why not? Aren't you going to let them? The little girl said that you were going to make an empire.
I don't care what she's... What was that?
He strode to Kalia and caught her firmly above the elbow, so that his fingers sank deeply into the soft flesh.
What did she tell you?
You're hurting me. I can't remember what she said, if you're going to look at me like that.
He released her, and she stood there for a moment, rubbing vainly at the red marks. She whimpered.
The little girl made me promise not to tell.
That's too bad. Tell me. Now.
Well, she said the Selden Plan was changed, and that there was another foundation somewheres that was arranging to have you make an empire, that's all. She said Mr. Munn was a very important scientist, and that the Mule's Palace would have proof of all that. That's every bit of what she said. Are you angry?
But Stetton did not answer. He left the room, hurriedly, with Kalia's cow-like eyes staring mournfully after him. Two orders were sent out over the official seal of the First Citizen before the hour was up. One had the effect of sending 500 ships of the line into space on what were officially to be termed as war games. The other had the effect of throwing a single man into confusion. Homier Munn ceased his preparations to leave when that second order reached him. It was, of course, official permission to enter the Palace of the Mule. He read and reread it with anything but joy. But Arcadia was delighted. She knew what had happened. Or at any rate, she thought she did. Chapter 14. Anxiety. Poli placed the breakfast on the table, keeping one eye on the table news recorder, which quietly disgorged the bulletins of the day. It could be done easily enough without loss of efficiency, this one-eye absent business, since all items of food were sterilely packed in containers which served as discardable cooking units. Her duties vis-a-vis breakfast consisted of nothing more than choosing the menu, placing the items on the table, and removing the residue thereafter. She clacked her tongue at what she saw, and moaned softly in retrospect. "Oh, people are so wicked," she said, and Daryl merely hemmed in reply. Her voice took on the high-pitched rasp which she automatically assumed when about to bewail the evil of the world. "Now why do these terrible Kalganese," she accented the second syllable and gave it a long A, "do like that? You'd think they'd give a body peace, but no, it's just trouble, trouble all the time. Now look at that headline. Mobs riot before Foundation Consulate. Oh, would I like to give them a piece of my mind if I could. That's the trouble with people, they just don't remember. They just don't remember. Dr. Daryl got no memory at all. Look at the last war after the mule died. Of course, I was just a little girl then, and oh, the fuss and trouble. My own uncle was killed, him being just in his 20s and only 2 years married with a baby girl. I remember him even yet, blonde hair he had and a dimple in his chin. I have a trimensional cube of him somewheres. And now his baby girl has a son of her own in the Navy, and most like if anything happens. And we had the bombardment patrols and all the old men taking turns in the stratospheric defense. I could imagine what they would have been able to do if the Kalganese had come that far. My mother used to tell us children about the food rationing and the prices and the taxes. A body could hardly make ends meet. You'd think if they had sense, people would just never want to start it again, just have nothing to do with it. And I suppose it's not people that do it, either. I suppose even Kalganese would rather sit at home with their families and not go fooling around in ships and getting killed. It's that awful man Stettin. It's a wonder people like that are let live. He kills the old man, what's his name, Thallos, and now he's just spoiling to be boss of everything. And why he wants to fight us, I don't know. He's bound to lose, like they always do. And maybe it's all in the plan, but sometimes I'm sure it must be a wicked plan to have so much fighting and killing in it. Though to be sure I haven't a word to say about Harry Seldon, who I'm sure knows much more about that than I do, and perhaps I'm a fool to question him, and the other Foundation is as much to blame. They could stop Kalgan now and make everything fine. They'll do it anyway in the end, and you'd think they'd do it before there's any damage done. Dr. Daryl looked up. Did you say something, Poli? Poli's eyes widened, then narrowed angrily. Nothing, Doctor. Nothing at all. I haven't got a word to say. A body could as soon choke to death as say a word in this house. It's jump here and jump there, but just try to say a word. And she went off simmering. Her leaving made as little impression on Daryl as did her speaking. Kalgan. Nonsense. A merely physical enemy. These had always been beaten. Yet he could not divorce himself of the current foolish crisis. 7 days earlier, the mayor had asked him to be administrator of research and development. He had promised to answer today. Well, he stirred uneasily. Why himself? Yet could he refuse? It would seem strange, and he dared not seem strange. After all, what did he care about Kalgan? To him there was only one enemy, always had been. While his wife had lived, he was only too glad to shirk the task, to hide. Those long, quiet days on Trantor, with the ruins of the past about them, the silence of a wrecked world and the forgetfulness of it all. But she had died. Less than 5 years, all told, it had been. And after that, he knew that he could live only by fighting that vague and fearful enemy that deprived him of the dignity of manhood by controlling his destiny, that made life a miserable struggle against a foreordained end, that made all the universe a hateful and deadly chess game. Call it sublimation. He himself did call it that. But the fight gave meaning to his life. First to the University of Santani, where he had joined Dr. Cleese. It had been 5 years well spent. And yet Cleese was merely a gatherer of data. He could not succeed in the real task. And when Daryl had felt that as certainty, he knew it was time to leave. Cleese may have worked in secret, yet he had to have men working for him and with him. He had subjects whose brains he probed. He had a university that backed him. All these were weaknesses. Cleese could not understand that, and he, Darrell, could not explain that. They parted enemies. It was well. They had to. He had to leave in surrender, in case someone watched. Where Cleese worked with charts, Darrell worked with mathematical concepts in the recesses of his mind. Cleese worked with many, Darrell with none. Cleese in a university, Darrell in the quiet of a suburban house. And he was almost there. A second foundationer is not human as far as his cerebrum is concerned. The cleverest psychologist, the most subtle neurochemist, might detect nothing. Yet the difference must be there. And since the difference was one of the mind, it was there that it must be detectable. Given a man like the mule, and there was no doubt that the second foundationers had the mule's powers, whether inborn or acquired, with the power of detecting and controlling human emotions, deduce from that the electronic circuit required, and deduce from that the last details of the encephalograph on which it could not help but be betrayed. And now Cleese had returned into his life in the person of his ardent young pupil, Anthor. Folly. Folly. With his graphs and charts of people who had been tampered with, he had learned to detect that years ago, but of what use was it? He wanted the arm, not the tool. Yet he had to agree to join Anthor, since it was the quieter course. Just as now he would become administrator of research and development, it was the quieter course. And so he remained a conspiracy within a conspiracy. The thought of Arcadia teased him for a moment, and he shuddered away from it. Left to himself, it would never have happened. Left to himself, no one would ever have been endangered but himself. Left to himself, he felt the anger rising against the dead Cleese, the living Anthor, all the well-meaning fools. Well, she could take care of herself. She was a very mature little girl. She could take care of herself. It was a whisper in his mind. Yet could she? At the moment that Dr. Darrell told himself mournfully that she could, she was sitting in the coldly austere anteroom of the executive offices of the First Citizen of the Galaxy. For half an hour she had been sitting there, her eyes sliding slowly about the walls. There had been two armed guards at the door when she had entered with Homer Munn. They hadn't been there the other times. She was alone now, yet she sensed the unfriendliness of the very furnishings of the room, and for the first time. Now why should that be? Homer was with Lord Stetton. Well, was that wrong? It made her furious. In similar situations, in the book films and the videos, the hero foresaw the conclusion, was prepared for it when it came. And she just sat there. Anything could happen. Anything. And she just sat there. Well, back again. Think it back. Maybe something would come. For 2 weeks, Homer had nearly lived inside the mule's palace. He had taken her once, with Stetton's permission. It was large and gloomily massive, shrinking from the touch of life to lie sleeping within its ringing memories, answering the footsteps with a hollow boom or a savage clatter. She hadn't liked it. Better the great gay highways of the capital city, the theaters and spectacles of a world essentially poorer than the Foundation, yet spending more of its wealth on display. Homer would return in the evening, awed. "It's a dream world for me," he would whisper. "If I could only chip the palace down stone by stone, layer by layer of the aluminum sponge, if I could carry it back to Terminus, what a museum it would make." He seemed to have lost that early reluctance. He was eager instead, glowing. Arcadia knew that by the one sure sign. He practically never stuttered throughout that period. One time he said, "There are abstracts of the records of General Pritcher. I know him. He was the Foundation renegade who combed the galaxy for the second Foundation, wasn't he?" "Not exactly a renegade, Arcady. The mule had converted him." "Oh, it's the same thing." "Galaxy. That combing you speak of was a hopeless task. The original records of the Selden Convention that established both Foundations 500 years ago make only one reference to the second Foundation. They say it's located at the other end of the galaxy, at Star's End. That's all the mule and Pritcher had to go on. They had no method of recognizing the second Foundation, even if they found it. What madness! They have records." He was speaking to himself, but Arcadia listened eagerly. "Which must cover nearly 1,000 worlds.
Yet the number of worlds available for study must have been closer to 1,000,000. And we are no better off.
Arcadia broke in anxiously.
Shh!
In a tight hiss. Homer froze and slowly recovered.
Let's not talk, he mumbled.
And now Homer was with Lord Stetton, and Arcadia waited outside alone and felt the blood squeezing out of her heart for no reason at all. That was more frightening than anything else, that there seemed no reason. On the other side of the door, Homer, too, was living in a sea of gelatin. He was fighting with furious intensity to keep from stuttering and, of course, could scarcely speak 2 consecutive words clearly as a result. Lord Stetton was in full uniform, 6'6", large-jawed and hard-mouthed. His bald, arrogant fists kept a powerful time to his sentences.
Well, you have had 2 weeks, and you come to me with tales of nothing. Come, sir, tell me the worst. Is my navy to be cut to ribbons? Am I to fight the ghosts of the Second Foundation as well as the men of the First?
I repeat, my lord, I am no predictor. I am at a complete loss.
Or do you wish to go back to warn your countrymen? To deep space with your play-acting. I want the truth, or I'll have it out of you along with half your guts.
I'm telling only the truth, and I'll have you remember, my lord, that I am a citizen of the Foundation.
You cannot touch me without harvesting more than you count on.
The Lord of Calgan laughed uproariously.
A threat to frighten children! A horror with which to beat back an idiot! Come, Mr. Munn, I have been patient with you. I have listened to you for 20 minutes while you detailed wearisome nonsense to me, which must have cost you sleepless nights to compose. It was wasted effort. I know you are here not merely to rake through the mule's dead ashes and to warm over the cinders you find. You come here for more than you have admitted. Is that not true?
Homer Munn could no more have quenched the burning horror that grew in his eyes than at that moment he could have breathed. Lord Stetton saw that and clapped the Foundation man upon his shoulder so that he and the chair he sat on reeled under the impact.
Good. Now let us be frank. You are investigating the Selden plan. You know that it no longer holds. You know, perhaps, that I am the inevitable winner now. I and my heirs. Well, man, what matters it who established the Second Empire so long as it is established? History plays no favorites, huh? Are you afraid to tell me?
You see that I know your mission. Munn said thickly,
what is it you want?
Your presence. I would not wish the plan spoiled through overconfidence. You understand more of these things than I do. You can detect small flaws that I might miss.
Come, you will be rewarded in the end. You will have your fair glut of the loot. What can you expect at the Foundation? To turn the tide of a perhaps inevitable defeat? To lengthen the war? Or is it merely a patriotic desire to die for your country?
He finally spluttered into silence. Not a word would come.
You will stay, said the Lord of Calgan confidently. You have no choice. Wait, an almost forgotten afterthought. I have information to the effect that your niece is of the family of Beta Darrow.
Homer uttered a startled,
yes.
He could not trust himself at this point to be capable of weaving anything but cold truth.
Is it a family of note on the Foundation?
Homer nodded.
To whom they would certainly brook no harm.
Harm?
Don't be a fool, man. I am meditating the reverse. How old is she?
14.
So? Well, not even the Second Foundation or Harry Selden himself could stop time from passing or girls from becoming women.
With that, he turned on his heel and strode to a draped door, which he threw open violently. He thundered,
what in space have you dragged your shivering carcass here for?
The Lady Calia blinked at him and said in a small voice,
I didn't know anyone was with you.
Well, there is. I'll speak to you later of this, but now I want to see your back, and quickly.
Her footsteps were a fading scurry in the corridor. Stetton returned.
She is a remnant of an interlude that has lasted too long. It will end soon. 14, you say?
Homer stared at him with a brand new horror. Arcadia started at the noiseless opening of a door, jumping at the jangling sliver of movement it made in the corner of her eye. The finger that crooked frantically at her met no response for long moments. And then, as if in response to the cautions enforced by the very sight of that white, trembling figure, she tiptoed her way across the floor. Their footsteps were a taut whisper in the corridor. It was the Lady Calia, of course, who held her hand so tightly that it hurt, and for some reason she did not mind following her. Of the Lady Calia, at least, she was not afraid. Now, why was that? They were in a boudoir now, all pink fluff and spun sugar. Lady Calia stood with her back against the door. She said, "This was our private way to me, to my room, you know, from his office. His, you know." And she pointed with a thumb, as though even the thought of him were grinding her soul to death with fear. "It's so lucky, it's so lucky." Her pupils had blackened out the blue with their size. "Can you tell me," began Arcadia timidly, and Calia was in frantic motion. "No, child, no. There is no time. Take off your clothes. Please, please. I'll get you more, and they won't recognize you." She was in the closet, throwing useless bits of flumery in reckless heaps upon the ground, looking madly for something a girl could wear without becoming a living invitation to dalliance. "Here, this will do. It will have to. You have money. Here, take it all. And this." She was stripping her ears and fingers. "Just go home. Go home to your foundation." This book is continued on cassette number 6. "Here, this will do. It will have to. You have money. Here, take it all. And this." She was stripping her ears and fingers. "Just go home. Go home to your foundation." "But Homier, my uncle..." She protested vainly through the muffling folds of the sweet-smelling and luxurious spun metal being forced over her head. "He won't leave. Poochie will hold him forever, but you mustn't stay." "Oh, dear, don't you understand?" "No." Arcadia forced a standstill. "I don't understand." Lady Calia squeezed her hands tightly together. "You must go back to warn your people there will be war. Isn't that clear?" Absolute terror seemed paradoxically to have lent a lucidity to her thoughts and words that was entirely out of character. "Now come!" Out another way, past officials who stared after them, but saw no reason to stop one whom only the Lord of Calgan could stop with impunity. Guards clicked heels and presented arms when they went through doors. Arcadia breathed only on occasion through the years the trip seemed to take. Yet from the first crooking of the white finger to the time she stood at the outer gate, with people and noise and traffic in the distance, was only 25 minutes. She looked back with a sudden frightened pity. I don't know why you're doing this, my lady, but thanks. What's going to happen to Uncle Homier?" "I don't know," wailed the other. "Can't you leave? Go straight to the spaceport. Don't wait. He may be looking for you this very minute." And still Arcadia lingered. She would be leaving Homier, and belatedly, now that she felt the free air about her, she was suspicious. "But what do you care if he does?" Lady Calia bit her lower lip and muttered, "I can't explain to a little girl like you. It would be improper. Well, you'll be growing up, and I met Poochie when I was 16. I can't have you about, you know." There was a half-ashamed hostility in her eyes. The implications froze Arcadia. She whispered, "What will he do to you when he finds out?" And she whimpered back, "I don't know," and threw her arm to her head as she left at a half run, back along the wide way to the mansion of the Lord of Calgan. But for one eternal second, Arcadia still did not move. For in that last moment before Lady Calia left, Arcadia had seen something. Those frightened, frantic eyes had momentarily, flashingly, lit up with a cold amusement. A vast, inhuman amusement. It was much to see in such a quick flicker of a pair of eyes, but Arcadia had no doubt of what she saw. She was running now, running wildly, searching madly for an unoccupied public booth at which one could press a button for public conveyance. She was not running from Lord Stetton, not from him or from all the human hounds he could place at her heels, not from all his 27 worlds rolled up into a single gigantic phenomenon, hallooing at her shadow. She was running from a single frail woman who had helped her escape, from a creature who had loaded her with money and jewels, who had risked her own life to save her, from an entity she knew, certainly and finally, to be a woman of the Second Foundation. An air taxi came to a soft, clicking halt in the cradle. The wind of its coming brushed against Arcadia's face and stirred at the hair beneath the softly furred hood Kalia had given her. "Where'll it be, lady?" She fought desperately to low-pitch her voice to make it not that of a child. "How many spaceports in the city?"
"Two. Which one you want?"
"Which is closer?" He stared at her.
"Calgan Central, lady."
The other one, please. I've got the money." She had a 20 Calganid note in her hand. The denomination of the note made little difference to her, but the taxi man grinned appreciatively.
"Anything you say, lady. Skyline cabs take you anywhere."
She cooled her cheek against the slightly musty upholstery. The lights of the city moved leisurely below her. What should she do? What should she do? It was in that moment that she knew she was a stupid, stupid little girl, away from her father and frightened. Her eyes were full of tears, and deep down in her throat there was a small, soundless cry that hurt her insides. She wasn't afraid that Lord Stettin would catch her. Lady Kalia would see to that. Lady Kalia. Old, fat, stupid, but she held on to her lord somehow. Oh, it was clear enough now. Everything was clear. That tea with Kalia, at which she had been so smart. Clever little Arcadia. Something inside Arcadia choked and hated itself. That tea had been maneuvered, and then Stettin had probably been maneuvered, so that Homir was allowed to inspect the palace after all. She, the foolish Kalia, has wanted it so, and arranged to have smart little Arcadia supply a foolproof excuse, one which would arouse no suspicions in the minds of the victims, and yet involve a minimum of interference on her part. Then why was she free? Homir was a prisoner, of course. Unless she went back to the Foundation as a decoy to lead others into the hands of them, so she couldn't return to the Foundation. "Spaceport, lady." The air taxi had come to a halt. Strange, she hadn't even noticed. What a dream world it was. "Thanks." She pushed the bill at him without seeing anything, and was stumbling out the door, then running across the springy pavement. Lights. Unconcerned men and women, large, gleaming bulletin boards with the moving figures that followed every single spaceship that arrived and departed. Where was she going? She didn't care. She only knew that she wasn't going to the Foundation. Anywhere else at all would suit. Oh, thanks Selden for that forgetful moment, that last split second when Kalia wearied of her act because she had to do only with a child, and had let her amusement spring through. And then something else occurred to Arcadia. Something that had been stirring and moving at the base of her brain ever since the flight began. Something that forever killed the 14 in her. And she knew that she must escape. That above all. Though they located every conspirator on the Foundation, though they caught her own father, she could not, dared not, risk a warning. She could not risk her own life, not in the slightest, for the entire realm of Terminus. She was the most important person in the galaxy. She was the only important person in the galaxy. She knew that, even as she stood before the ticket machine and wondered where to go. Because in all the galaxy, she and she alone, except for they themselves, knew the location of the Second Foundation. Chapter 15. Through the Grid. Trantor. By the middle of the interregnum, Trantor was a shadow. In the midst of colossal ruins, there lived a small community of farmers. Encyclopedia Galactica. There is nothing, never has been anything, quite like a busy spaceport on the outskirts of a capital city of a populous planet. There are those huge machines resting mightily in their cradles. If you choose your time properly, there is the impressive sight of the sinking giant dropping to rest, or more hair-raising still, the swiftening departure of a bubble of steel. All processes involved are nearly noiseless. The motive power is the silent surge of nucleons, shifting into more compact arrangements. In terms of area, 95% of the port has just been referred to. Square miles are reserved for the machines, and for the men who serve them, and for the calculators that serve both. Only 5% of the port is given over to the floods of humanity, to whom it is the way station to all the stars of the galaxy. It is certain that very few of the anonymous many-headed stop to consider the technological mesh that knits the spaceways. Perhaps some of them might itch occasionally at the thought of the thousands of tons represented by the sinking steel that looks so small off in the distance. One of those cyclopean cylinders could, conceivably, miss the guiding beam and crash half a mile from its expected landing point, through the glassite roof of the immense waiting room, perhaps, so that only a thin organic vapor and some powdered phosphates would be left behind to mark the passing of 1,000 men. It could never happen, however, with the safety devices in use, and only the badly neurotic would consider the possibility for more than a moment. Then what do they think about? It is not just a crowd, you see. It is a crowd with a purpose. That purpose hovers over the field and thickens the atmosphere. Lines queue up, parents herd their children, baggage is maneuvered in precise masses, people are going somewheres. Consider then the complete psychic isolation of a single unit of this terribly intent mob that does not know where to go, yet at the same time feels more intensely than any of the others possibly can the necessity of going somewheres, anywhere, or almost anywhere. Even lacking telepathy or any of the crudely definite methods of mind-touching mind, there is a sufficient clash in atmosphere, an intangible mood, to suffice for despair. To suffice? To overflow, and drench, and drown. Arcadia Darrow, dressed in borrowed clothes, standing on a borrowed planet, in a borrowed situation, of what seemed even to be a borrowed life, wanted earnestly the safety of the womb. She didn't know that was what she wanted. She only knew that the very openness of the open world was a great danger. She wanted a closed spot somewhere, somewhere far, somewhere in an unexplored nook of the universe, where no one would ever look. And there she was, age 14 plus, weary enough for 80 plus, frightened enough for 5 minus. What stranger of the hundreds that brushed past her, actually brushed past her so that she could feel their touch, was a second foundationer? What stranger could not help but instantly destroy her for her guilty knowledge, her unique knowledge, of knowing where the second foundation was? And the voice that cut in on her was a thunderclap that iced the scream in her throat into a voiceless slash. "Look, miss," it said irritably, "are you using that ticket machine or are you just standing there?" It was the first she realized that she was standing in front of a ticket machine. You put a high denomination bill into the clipper, which sank out of sight. You press the button below your destination, and a ticket came out, together with the correct change, as determined by an electronic scanning device that never made a mistake. It was a very ordinary thing, and there is no cause for anyone to stand before it for 5 minutes. Arcadia plunged a 200 credit into the clipper, and was suddenly aware of the button labeled Trantor. Trantor, dead capital of the dead empire, the planet on which she was born. She pressed it in a dream. Nothing happened, except that the red letters flicked on and off, reading 172.18, 172.18, 172.18. It was the amount she was short. Another 200 credit. The ticket was spit out towards her. It came loose when she touched it, and the change tumbled out afterward. She seized it and ran. She felt the man behind her pressing close, anxious for his own chance at the machine. But she twisted out from before him and did not look behind. Yet there was nowhere to run. They were all her enemies. Without quite realizing it, she was watching the gigantic, glowing signs that puffed into the air. Stefani, Anacreon, Fermus. There was even that one ballooned Terminus, and she longed for it, but did not dare. For a trifling sum, she could have hired a notifier, which could have been set for any destination she cared, and which would, when placed in her purse, make itself heard only to her, 15 minutes before takeoff time. But such devices are for people who are reasonably secure, however, who can pause to think of them. And then, attempting to look both ways simultaneously, she ran head-on into a soft abdomen. She felt the startled out-breath and grunt, and a hand came down on her arm. She writhed desperately, but lacked breath to do more than mew a bit in the back of her throat. Her captor held her firmly and waited. Slowly he came into focus for her, and she managed to look at him. He was rather plump and rather short. His hair was white and copious, being brushed back to give a pompadour effect that looked strangely incongruous above a round and ruddy face that shrieked its peasant origin.
"What's the matter?" he said finally, with a frank and twinkling curiosity. "You look scared."
"Sorry," muttered Arcadia in a frenzy. I've got to go, pardon me." But he disregarded that entirely and said,
"Watch out, little girl, you'll drop your ticket."
And he lifted it from her resistless white fingers and looked at it with every evidence of satisfaction.
"I thought so," he said, and then bawled in bull-like tones, "Mama!"
A woman was instantly at his side, somewhat more short, somewhat more round, somewhat more ruddy. She wound a finger about a stray gray lock to shove it beneath a well-outmoded hat.
"Papa," she said reprovingly, "why do you shout in a crowd like that? People look at you like you were crazy. You think you're on the farm?"
And she smiled sunnily at the unresponsive Arcadia and added, "He has manners like a bear." Then sharply,
"Papa, let go the little girl. What are you doing?"
But Papa simply waved the ticket at her.
"Look," he said, "she's going to Trantor."
Mama's face was a sudden beam.
"You're from Trantor? Let go of her arm, I say, Papa."
She turned the overstuffed valise she was carrying onto its side and forced Arcadia to sit down with a gentle but unrelenting pressure.
"Sit down," she said, "and rest your little feet. It will be no ship yet for an hour, and the benches are crowded with sleeping loafers. You are from Trantor?"
Arcadia drew a deep breath and gave in. Huskily, she said, "I was born there." And Mama clapped her hands gleefully.
"1 month we've been here, and till now we've met nobody from home. This is very nice. Your parents?"
She looked about vaguely.
"I'm not with my parents," Arcadia said carefully. "All alone? A little girl like you?"
Mama was at once a blend of indignation and sympathy.
"How does that come to be?"
"Mama," Papa plucked at her sleeve,
"let me tell you. There's something wrong. I think she's frightened."
His voice, though obviously intended for a whisper, was quite plainly audible to Arcadia.
"She was running. I was watching her, and not looking where she was going. Before I could step out of the way, she bumped into me. And you know what? I think she's in trouble."
"So shut your mouth, Papa. Into you anybody could bump." But she joined Arcadia on the valise, which creaked wearily under the added weight, and put an arm about the girl's trembling shoulder.
"You're running away from somebody, sweetheart? Don't be afraid to tell me. I'll help you."
Arcadia looked across at the kind gray eyes of the woman and felt her lips quivering. One part of her brain was telling her that here were people from Trantor with whom she could go, who could help her remain on that planet until she could decide what next to do, where next to go. And another part of her brain, much the louder, was telling her in jumbled incoherence that she did not remember her mother, that she was weary to death of fighting the universe, that she wanted only to curl into a little ball with strong, gentle arms about her, that if her mother had lived, she might. And for the first time that night, she was crying like a little baby, and glad of it, clutching tightly at the old-fashioned dress, and dampening a corner of it thoroughly, while soft arms held her closely, and a gentle hand stroked her curls. Papa stood helplessly, looking at the pair, fumbling futilely for a handkerchief, which, when produced, was snatched from his hand. Mama glared in admonition of quietness at him. The crowd surged about the little group with the true indifference of disconnected crowds everywhere. They were effectively alone. Finally, the weeping trickled to a halt, and Arcadia smiled weakly as she dabbed at red eyes with the borrowed handkerchief.
"Golly," she whispered.
"Don't talk," said Mama fussily. "Just sit and rest for a while. Catch your breath. Then tell us what's wrong, and you'll see we'll fix it up, and everything will be all right." Arcadia scrabbled what remained of her wits together. She could not tell them the truth. She could tell nobody the truth. And yet she was too worn to invent a useful lie. She said whisperingly, "I'm better now."
"Good," said Mama. "Now tell me why you're in trouble. You did nothing wrong? Of course, whatever you did, we'll help you, but tell us the truth. For a friend from Trantor, anything," added Papa expansively. "Ah, Mama?"
"Shut your mouth, Papa," was the response, without rancor. Arcadia was groping in her purse. That, at least, was still hers, despite the rapid clothes changing forced upon her in Lady Callia's apartments. She found what she was looking for and handed it to Mama. "These are my papers," she said diffidently. It was shiny synthetic parchment, which had been issued her by the Foundation's ambassador on the day of her arrival, and which had been countersigned by the appropriate Kalganian official. It was large, florid, and impressive. Mama looked at it helplessly and passed it to Papa, who absorbed its contents with an impressive pursing of the lips. He said, "You're from the Foundation?" "Yes, but I was born on Trantor. See, it says that..." "Aha! Looks all right to me. You're named Arcadia, huh? That's a good Trantorian name. But where's your uncle? Says here you came in the company of Homer Munn, uncle." "He's been arrested," said Arcadia drearily. "Arrested?" from the two of them at once. "What for?" asked Mama. "He did something?" She shook her head. "I don't know. We were just on a visit. Uncle Homer had business with Lord Stetton, but..." She needed no effort to act a shudder. It was there. Papa was impressed. "With Lord Stetton? Your uncle must be a big man." "I don't know what it was all about, but Lord Stetton wanted me to stay." She was recalling the last words of Lady Callia, which had been acted out for her benefit, since Callia, as she now knew, was an expert. The story could do for a second time. She paused, and Mama said interestedly, "And why you?" "I'm not sure. He wanted to have dinner with me all alone, but I said no because I wanted Uncle Homer along. He looked at me funny and kept holding my shoulder." Papa's mouth was a little open, but Mama was suddenly red and angry. "How old are you, Arcadia?" 14 and a half, almost." Mama drew a sharp breath and said, "That such people should be let live. The dogs in the streets are better. You're running from him, dear, is not?" Arcadia nodded. Mama said, "Papa, go right to information and find out exactly when the ship to Trantor comes to berth. Hurry!" But Papa took one step and stopped. Loud metallic words were booming overhead, and 5,000 pairs of eyes looked startledly upwards. "Men and women," it said with sharp force. "The airport is being searched for a dangerous fugitive, and it is now surrounded. No one can enter and no one can leave. The search will, however, be conducted with great speed, and no ships will reach or leave berth during the interval, so that you will not miss your ship. I repeat, no one will miss his ship. The grid will descend. None of you will move outside your square until the grid is removed, as otherwise we will be forced to use Onuronic whips." During the minute or less in which the voice dominated the vast dome of the spaceport's waiting room, Arcadia could not have moved if all the evil in the galaxy had concentrated itself into a ball and hurled itself at her. They could mean only her. It was not even necessary to formulate that idea as a specific thought. But why? Callia had engineered her escape, and Callia was of the Second Foundation. Why then the search now? Had Callia failed? Could Callia fail? Or was this part of the plan, the intricacies of which escaped her? For a vertiginous moment, she wanted to jump up and shout that she gave up, that she would go with them, that... But Mama's hand was on her wrist. "Quick, quick! We'll go to the ladies' room before they start." Arcadia did not understand. She merely followed blindly. They oozed through the crowd, frozen as it was into clumps, with the voice still booming through its last words. The grid was descending now, and Papa, open-mouthed, watched it come down. He had heard of it and read of it, but had never actually been the object of it. It glimmered in the air, simply a series of cross-hatched and tight radiation beams that set the air aglow in a harmless network of flashing light. It was always so arranged as to descend slowly from above in order that it might represent a falling net with all the terrific psychological implications of entrapment. It was at waist level now, 10 feet between glowing lines in each direction. In his own 100 square feet, Papa found himself alone, yet the adjoining squares were crowded. He felt himself conspicuously isolated, but knew that to move into the greater anonymity of a group would have meant crossing one of those glowing lines, stirring an alarm, and bringing down the neuronic whip. He waited. He could make out over the heads of the eerily quiet and waiting mob the far-off stir that was the line of policemen covering the vast floor area, lighted square by lighted square. It was a long time before a uniform stepped into his square and carefully noted its coordinates into an official notebook. "Papers?" Papa handed them over, and they were flipped through in expert fashion. "You're Preem Palver, native of Trantor, on Kalgan for a month, returning to Trantor. Answer yes or no." "Yes, yes." "What's your business on Kalgan?" "I'm trading representative of our farm cooperative. I've been negotiating terms with the Department of Agriculture on Kalgan." "Hmm. Your wife is with you. Where is she?" "She is mentioned in your papers." "Please, my wife is in the..." He pointed. "Anto!" roared the policeman. Another uniform joined him. The first one said dryly, "Another dame in a can, by the galaxy. Place must be busting with them. Write down her name." He indicated the entry in the papers, which gave it. "Anyone else with you?" "My niece. She's not mentioned in the papers. She came separately." "Where is she?" "Never mind, I know. Write down the niece's name too, Hanto. What's her name?" "Write down Arcadia Palver." "You stay right here, Palver. We'll take care of the women before we leave." Papa waited interminably. And then, long, long after, Mama was marching towards him, Arcadia's hand firmly in hers, the two policemen trailing behind her. They entered Papa's square, and one said, "Is this noisy old woman your wife?" "Yes, sir," said Papa, placatingly. "Then you'd better tell her she's liable to get into trouble if she talks the way she does to the First Citizens Police." He straightened his shoulders angrily. "Is this your niece?" "Yes, sir. I want her papers." Looking straight at her husband, Mama slightly, but no less firmly, shook her head. A short pause, and Papa said with a weak smile, "I don't think I can do that." "What do you mean you can't do that?" The policeman thrust out a hard palm. "Hand it over." "Diplomatic immunity," said Papa softly. "What do you mean?" "I said I was a trading representative of my farm cooperative. I'm accredited to the Kalganian government as an official foreign representative, and my papers prove it. I showed them to you, and now I don't want to be bothered any more." For a moment, the policeman was taken aback. "I've got to see your papers. It's orders." "You go away," broke in Mama suddenly. "When we want you, we'll send for you, you bum." The policeman's lips tightened. "Keep your eye on him, Hanto. I'll get the lieutenant." "Break a leg," called Mama after him. Someone laughed and then choked it off suddenly. The search was approaching its end. The crowd was growing dangerously restless. 45 minutes had elapsed since the grid had started falling, and that is too long for best effects. Lieutenant DeRidge threaded his way hastily, therefore, through the dense center of the mob. "Is this the girl?" he asked wearily. He looked at her, and she obviously fitted the description. "All this for a child," he said. "Her papers, if you please." Papa began. "I have already explained..." "I know what you've explained, and I'm sorry," said the lieutenant. "But I have my orders, and I can't help them. If you care to make a protest later, you may. Meanwhile, if necessary, I must use force." There was a pause, and the lieutenant waited patiently. Then Papa said huskily, "Give me your papers, Arcadia." Arcadia shook her head in panic, but Papa nodded his head. "Don't be afraid. Give them to me." Helplessly, she reached out and let the documents change hands. Papa fumbled them open and looked carefully through them, then handed them over. The lieutenant, in his turn, looked them through carefully. For a long moment, he raised his eyes to rest them on Arcadia, and then he closed the booklet with a sharp snap. "All in order," he said. "All right, men." He left, and in 2 minutes, scarcely more, the grid was gone, and the voice above signified a back to normal. The noise of the crowd, suddenly released, rose high. Arcadia said,
How?
Papa said, "Shh, don't say a word. Let's better go to the ship. It should be in the berth soon." They were on the ship. They had a private stateroom and a table to themselves in the dining room. 2 light years already separated them from Kalgan, and Arcadia finally dared to broach the subject again. She said, "But they were after me, Mr. Palver, and they must have had my description and all the details. Why did he let me go?" And Papa smiled broadly over his roast beef. "Well, Arcadia, child, it was easy. When you've been dealing with agents and buyers and competing cooperatives, you learn of some tricks. I've had 20 years or more to learn them in. You see, child,
When the lieutenant opened your papers, he found a 500-credit bill inside, folded up small. Simple, no?
I'll pay you back. Honest, I've got lots of money.
Well, Papa's broad face broke into an embarrassed smile as he waved it away. For a countrywoman, Arcadia...